they invite me to go sing my bolero for Mother's Day. I tell them, I say, international, Mr. No, I'm not international, I'm not even interprovincial now. I am interparochial, parish, you know. I enjoy life. That's the thing, I enjoy life. I enjoy serving people. And this is what I told the kids at the school. Try to be part of the community, you know. Be effective. Be good at something.
Right. Add to the betterment of the world.
Of the community. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So you have your question here.
Oh yes. We take it seriously.
And the camera is rolling.
Yes, sir.
Oh my God.
The audio.
Just the audio.
Yes.
Okay.
At right now. Because again, I document my information as well.
Okay.
Everything is on here.
I think this book with Mrs. Francisco Buckley.
Okay.
And he has so much connections, you know. Mm-hmm.
That would be everything.
Basically, what I just said. Everything important to the people here in the capital city.
Mm-hmm.
Everything here that's done is important.
Oh yeah.
Anything else done in Colón, you know, it's secondary.
That they just, that's their hierarchy that they.
And you're getting a lot of information, a lot of publicity for things that
are
only music, political, and everything else that's happening in other interior areas of Panama. Because many of the governors here in Panama, when I say governor, I mean people in high politics, all right? They are from Las Tablas or from
Chile. Right, so they specifically connect to that.
From Chiriquí, you know.
No,
and when we get our colonenses up there, like they just don't hear, you know, most of them.
Most of them, yes. So I have these questions here, and I know you have a lot of different things that we can talk about. We're going to envision this interview as sort of a first pass through of everything that we could possibly talk about.
Okay.
So there are some very specific questions here and very specific things that we'll ask you to talk about to provide kind of the way we'll create like a snapshot of the particular
scenario.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So examples and the instances and things. So you already worked with the kids, so you can envision the types of things that would work. You know, what kind of things would really get them to say, oh, that was what happened. Oh, that was how it is. So, all right.
Oh, yes. A red pen also. I should also turn this thing down, right?
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
look at the camera. I look at you. I keep looking at the camera.
So, good afternoon, Mr. Balmaceda.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this project. As you, I'm sure you will agree, it will surely benefit the community now and in the future.
Totally agreeable with that statement.
The goal of this questionnaire is to produce as detailed and coherent a narrative of your story, your experiences, as possible. So in light of that, I encourage you to feel free not to worry about providing an answer that is too detailed. That's what we want. I realize that you have already signed the consent form, but I also want to let you know that you should feel free to tell me if there's any particular thing that you say during the course of the interview that you'd like to keep, out of the educational exhibition or presentation material to be created based on these
things. Yeah, do that if I detect anything that may not be convenient, okay?
Right. So tell me about your place of birth and what was going on there as you were growing up.
That's an easy question. As a matter of fact, I think the questions on my life are all easy because I've lived it each moment. Because I was born in Cologne, as you know, Cologne City. We have to identify what Cologne City is. Just what was an island that the Americans filled in. And in 1852, there's a little history now about our Cologne, you know. 1852, after the French failed in trying to make a canal across the isthmus, Cologne to Panama, Cologne, whatever. Then the Americans came in, and they had already constructed a connecting point between the Atlantic and the Pacific, as history tells us, because of the gold rush in California. I love to tell this story because this is the basic history of Cologne. I tell people that we are not, so to speak, descendants of the Spaniards that came to conquer America. You know, we are an invention of the United States of America for their money-making purposes. That's what I feel, you know. The Americans make money. So they, in 1852, they needed a stop point on the Atlantic side for their railroad. That was the railroad that they constructed in order, because going across the United States from the east to the west was expensive, it was dangerous, history tells us. They decided to come by boat to the shortest route between Atlantic and Pacific, which is in Panama. So they had easily over here in Panama City, they had a point where they could have a railroad station. They needed one in Cologne. The idea was in the what we call the Cativa area. That's what history they say. But the people that owned the land there got smart, you know, they wanted millions. So they bought a little island called Manzanillo in those times from the government of Panama, from the government of Colombia, because we were dependent to Colombia in those areas. We were independent but annexed. Something I don't know to say if this is true, but something in Puerto Rico, okay? They're annexed to the government of the United States. We were annexed to the government of Colombia. And they built a railroad station on the island of Manzanillo and filled in to connect to the island, and that's where it all started, this Atlantic Pacific business. That was 1852. So at the start of the 20th century, when the French failed, that's where the Americans say, okay, we can do it. We can do it. And since
with the, in 1903 was the independence. They called it independence, but actually it was a separation, political separation from Colombia. And history tells us that the independence that we call was really done in Colón, because the Americans put a warship out there and told the Colombia, okay, you try something, huh? you try something. You want to attack the Colón people? You do it. Alright? This is why I say that we are a product of the American industry, can you call that? Our purpose is whatever. So, they got the concessions from the UNEP, from the Panama government, to build the Panama Canal. And then they had the railroad station, they filled in a little more, and then they organized and constructed the port of Cristobal. After years, I'm talking, I lived this, I was born in 1933, and I am talking about 1942, 43, 44 maybe, when Colón was surrounded with swamp, mostly swamp area. Then the Americans came in and dredged. They dredged in order to give depth to the waterway through the canal, to the entrance of the canal, Colón site. And with that dredging, they filled the north, south, east area of Colón. That's where the free zone is standing today. I saw that. I saw, as a matter of fact, I was 6 or 7 years old. My father, who was a cabinet maker, then a locksmith and so forth, he built what they call a carretilla, you know. It's a cart, okay, on four wheels. And he would take us out to the ball game. They played football out there, what they call the sand diamond. If you hear the Spanish talk about it, say sand diamond, you know. But it's sand diamond. That's the name the Americans gave it, the fill. That was all fill. If you have gone to Colón before, where the Colegio Abel Bravo is, where the stadium is, from 11th Street back, all the way back into the free zone. That was all filled in by the Americans. And that's where they built the free zone. So I keep insisting, some people didn't like when I said it at an interview a couple of years ago, that we're not descendants of the Spanish that came in to conquer America. We were an invention of the United States for their commercial purposes, and this is why I told the kids, this is the reason why my father, who never spoke a word of English, said, hey, English is for the future. And he taught us all with a Jamaican teacher in Colón, you know, that's where we learned our English. We were, as I say, we were introduced into, born into, grown with, you know, and developed our life around the West Indian culture. And this is probably why I know, you know, so much about what happened in Colón especially. So, coming back to the historic part of it, this is where your question again was concerning where I was born and what happened. This is what really happened. I was a part of that history of the development of the city of Colón. And I feel proud about it for those days. I don't know about it now. Some things have gone wrong over there in Colón. But my father came in from Nicaragua. My grandfather was from Martinique. Then my mother was born in Colón, French. And being poor, you may know that the canal was built, I would say, some 90% of West Indian people that were brought in because they could tolerate the heat. And many died. Many, many bodies are buried under that Panama Canal for sure. And then, as a poor family,
we got with all the people that were working in the canal zone. My father got the job as a cabinet maker. He was making 25 cents an hour. And I think he worked something like 10, 11 years. And then we had a room, a tenant building. You have the toilets outside in the back. And there is a big French construction type balcony, some 8-10 feet wide. And then the rooms were built, you know, something maybe about, each room was about 80% of this room here. And we had three rooms. Where we lived on 12th Street and Bolivar Avenue, across the street, the middle of the street where we was, that's Bolivar Avenue. Yeah, from the middle of the street back here was Panama, and from the middle of the street back there was you, Canal Zone. And you couldn't cross the street without some policeman. The Americans had their own little government over here. You know, it was something strange. I look back at it and say, well, maybe there was a reason for doing that. You know, they were the owners of the Panama Canal, and they were just taking care of it. Discipline was something fierce, very rigorous. You know, the police, they had their own police force. They had their own firemen, fire division. My brother worked for the fire division. Luis Balmaceda, he was one of the first Panamanians to work for the Canal Zone Fire Division. I think he was the fourth or fifth. He's retired now, of course. And then we were born on that building. We're five brothers and sisters. One of my sisters already died. But I'm the third. My eldest sister, who lives now in Alaska, she married an American. My brother Luis and myself, we were all delivered with a midwife right there at home. We didn't have any hospital like Amador Guerrero, you know, nowadays. They had a small hospital somewhere, I can't remember. But we were born out of with the midwife, right there on that building. And it was the Balmaceras. And next door was a Jamaican gentleman, Mr. McGregor. I can't remember his first name. But he came in from Jamaica. He was white. I mean, his skin was clear. And we would sit down every night with Mr. McGregor, and he would tell us a lot of stories about Jamaica, you know, how things are over there and so forth. And I mean, we were all poor family, but he had money. He had the corner, two rooms. As a matter of fact, the first time I put on a floor sheen shoes, he gave it to me. He was about two times the size of my feet. But Mr. McGregor, he would come home every afternoon, you know, and, hey, Mr. Mack, we would just line up and he would give us each a dime or a quarter or whatever. I probably learned something from him, you know. I mean, be generous. I always remember Mr. McGregor. And I always remember my father, who was that way also. He's a poor man, you know. He would sit down at the key shop. I would explain afterward, he had a locksmith shop. And every Sunday morning, he would sit down at the shop. And people next door, a building that had about 500 families, and I'm not kidding, they would just line up outside. It was about what's there, you know, give them what I need, it's okay. And he would give people quarters, at least he'd give away about $5-6, which is a fortune in those days. And I watched that, you know, and I said, you know, it's a nice thing. It's a nice thing to be generous. It's a God-given thing, and I think, I try to be that way, and I get back tenfold from the Lord, you know. I feel that He has been so good to me because I try to be good in life. Okay? Well, that's it. We were born in 12th Street, and Butler Avenue. We grew up there. We had all our friends. The building where we lived, as I said, the only Latin name on that building was Farmaceta. Then we had Mr. McGregor, we had the Mills, we had the Lynch, we had, there was one lady that she took care of us, a neighbor, Daisy. Can't remember the last name, but my mother loved that woman. My sister, up to the day she died. Daisy died before her, but she was good. Always, we're still talking about Daisy and how good she was with us. How she would care for us, you know. At one time, my parents, during the war, 1941, 42, 40 sometimes, my parents had ventured into business. There was a room where half of it was a key making thing that my dad did, and the other half was fruits, the fruit store, which my mother administered. And these ladies home, Miss Ruth, she cooked for us, and she wasn't a family cooker. She was a part of our family. She would take care of us, you know. We were brought up that way, you know, with loving people. We were brought up and we learned to love people. I still see some of the people from way back once in a while. Some of them are in Panama. And I said, I have enjoyed life from that nice beginning of life that I had. Okay? You want me to talk about education? Right? My father, as I said, he was a cabinet maker. Then, my grandfather was a locksmith. And he was paralyzed. He halfway paralyzed. He had a stroke. And he had a room. Same thing, tenant room, down in 9th Street and Amador Guerrero. I think you know that the streets were initially named by the Americans, which was D Street and G Street and M Street and whatever with a letter. But the Panamanian government started to give it names, you know, like Amador Guerrero, Melendez, and so forth. That's history. I don't know how deep I can go into history, but that's really what happened. And then my grandfather, he went back to Martinique. And my father had a very bad temper, maybe like me, you know, we go to the extremes. We can be too good or too reactive. And my grandfather said, come here, Casimiro, that was my father's name. That's the name he gave me, Jose Casimiro. Come here, Casimiro. I'm going to teach you to open safes and make keys. And you leave those gringos alone. Because you can't work with people like that, okay? And my father learned the trade quickly. My grandfather left, and the shop is still there in Colón after 70 years, you know, something like that. My brother is taking care of it now. Then my father went to the school. As far as I know, there was a Mr. Hector Connor, one of the best teachers that Colón has ever had. And he went over to the school and said, hey, Mr. Connor. My father never spoke a word of English. And he said, I can see the English language as something for the future. And I would like you to teach my children. There were three of us then. And I can't really pay you, you know, effectively every month or so forth. Suppose I repair your typewriters, because he repaired typewriters. So he swapped his ability to repair typewriters for our education. Eventually, he did get around to paying the fees and so forth. But that's something I admire. I always remember that my father, I said, is my hero. I think the kids, I said it to the kids, and they put it in big letters, you know, my parents are my heroes.
And I said that he will always be, has been, is, and will always be a hero. So this is how we got started off in the English language and our education. And I tell a story that after many years of how I got over to Abel Bravo, that's a public high school in Cologne. It was 1942, maybe 43, that Arnulfo Arias, as president of the Republic of Panama, he said, some of these schools, especially with these West Indians, Jamaicans, Barbadians, and so forth, you know, Trinidad teachers, there were many teachers. Cologne had prominent people that came in from Jamaica especially. I can remember Norman C. Brown. He was a pharmacist. And Mr. Kipping was also a pharmacist. Those are, and there again I learned about generosity. You know, people will go to Mr. Brown, I don't have money, and he said, here's your medicine, go ahead. You know, there was Mr. Kipping, there was Mr. Trim, he was born in Cologne. But Mr. Trim, who is sick right now, he was one of the foremost persons in music in Cologne. And so forth. There was a Mr. Jones. Mr. He worked in the theaters and so forth, you know. And knowing these people, you know, made me learn a lot of things. Then, as I said, I know 4 years one day said, okay, these schools are going to start teaching Spanish. We had a class of Spanish. But he said, their school program, their school itinerary is going to be the same as our public schools. Spanish and English will be a second language. In Cologne, not only there was a nuns Catholic school, the St. Joseph School, the Catholic schools, and I think there was a couple of schools also of other religions in Cologne, and he had everybody switch over to the government program, education program, where Spanish would be the important thing and then English as a second language. Then as I said, I say this as a joke, whatever. I was in ninth grade and I had something like 10 years old. 10, 11 years old. So Mr. Connor picked up the seventh grade, eighth grade, ninth grade, and tenth grade. And made a third grade in Spanish. I mean, it was confusing. Because we were, you wouldn't believe me, I started speaking Spanish when I was 11 years old. Because we spoke English at home, with the neighbors, all our friends, you know, we're all mostly English-speaking people. And then with this, I had to go back to third grade, go through third, fourth, fifth, sixth. Then I graduated from the Sir Connor School, you know, and we went and they said, okay, I go to Abel Bravo. That's a public school now, high school. Now remember, I went through 9 grades in English. And this is the program that Mr. Connor used, where I keep saying that I learned English out of a little book that says The Royal Reader. English from England. That's where I learned my English. The Royal Reader. So I went over to Abel Bravo. We had a Spanish teacher at Mr. Connor. So I went to Abel Bravo. The first day in English class, you know, this teacher says, now listen to me. Repeat after me. This is my pencil. Everybody, this is my pencil. I said, wow. After class, I said, profesora, yo puedo hablar mejor el español en inglés. I said, yeah, what school are you coming from? Escuela Dunbar del Señor Connor. El Señor Connor no venga más. don't come back anymore, you have your 5. 5 was the highest grading they gave now, alright? But if you want, you can have nails, you know, in mass. They started giving some, to me was a third grade mass, and then I went through it in a breeze, you know, and the first test I did in about 5 minutes. I always remember that. When I left the room, the teacher looked at my paper and said, come here, where are you from? I said, Mr. Connor's school. Help me. I want you to be my assistant. Said, okay. I was a first place graduate at the Connor's school. But the day in Spanish, our Spanish teacher was a Madrid-born professor. And she will, porque, you know, if I speak the Spanish or whatever. So I got my first thing in grammar and so forth. I got my 5 and 5 and 5 until the day she said, Balmaceda, your turn to read. And I read, porque los hombres, you know, things like that. So, hey, I want to talk to you after class. I said, this is the story of my life, okay? How come I got through the English and then Spanish? And he said, hey, wait a minute, you after classes, you speak English at home? I said, yes. But your name is Balmaceda, your father speaks English, I know. And how come you speak that? What school did you go? At the corner. Oh, he said, don't tell me that your professor was, I won't mention any name, he was a teacher in bookkeeping at the other Bravo, but he was also a teacher in bookkeeping at our school, Hector Connor's school, and he was assigned by Mr. Connor to teach Spanish, and he spoke with that accent, you know. He spoke with the accent, porque tú yo no sé qué, pero cuando, and we all spoke the same way. That's supposed to be a joke. Because afterwards, she says, all right, I want you to go home. Your father buys the Spanish papers. I say, yeah. Okay, you go home and read loud, read yourself. Don't care what anybody has to say. And I read. Until I kind of corrected. People tell me I still have that little English in my accent, you know. But I read. To the point, one day I started writing sports. I was 15 years old. I started writing the papers for free, but that was my cooperation, my community. And then another professor in second year, he says, third year, he says, hey, Bob said, all that thing you write in the papers, come with me, that I have a political program at a radio station, and you just read off your sports publications. So, well, me, I'm no sports announcer, you know, I'm no radio announcer. And he never spoke about payment, so I did it for free. I went and I started. Porque, señoras y señores, you know, I put on a voice and I learned a lot, believe me. I have been pushed into so many corners and say, all right, you get out of that corner. And I learned, and I always say that all the teaching that I got from Mr. Hector Connor, you know, because he was a writer himself. He wrote for one of the prominent West Indian papers, I would say, that was published in Panama. And he wrote a column called Facing Issues by Hector Connor. And every Friday at noon, he would call me up. He had a platform. And it was just one big room. There were about 200 students. 6th grade, 4th grade, 5th, whatever, you know, everybody just in groups in that one big room. And he would call me up, hey, Mama Sarah, come on up and type out my facing issues. And I had that task every Friday afternoon. Maybe that's where I got a feeling I love to do, you know, to write information. I love to do this. I like to research. I just love it. I always love this. Well, I guess that's the story of the beginning of my life. And everything else has just been over and over and over and over and over again. The things that I've been doing when I was 14, 15 years old, I'm still doing it. just like singing. It, at Connors School, I remember we sang spirituals. Though I was Catholic, you know, he would have some people come down and teach songs. Go down, Moses. Well, you know, it sounds like that, you know. Old Man River, this Paul Robeson, that great Negro singer from the Cayman, from the United States, he had him standing on our platform. He had a presentation in Cologne and kind of brought him down to our school, and I remember that. What did he sang Old Man River. Paul Robeson, one of the greatest singers that I can remember the United States have had. He sang that Old Man River, he keeps on strolling along. Real, real bass, you know. I'm just a baritone. and all of these enjoyable events that I've gone through in my life, most of it has been there at that school. I'm making friends, on singing, on research, on telling stories, you know. So that was basically it. From my belt bravo, I learned from as a kid, you know. Right now, the one song that people are asking me for, I sang it on radio a couple of weeks ago. There, this lady, Mayim Correa, she heard me sing it once, and they keep calling me. I was on radio 2 weeks ago singing My Way, and now the end is near. They love it. Frank Sinatra. You know, and when I was talking with the kids, I spoke about music as one of the best things I've done in my life, because it helped me know people. It communicate me with people. And then a couple of professors that know me showed up and say, Mama, so you're going to sing? I heard you're going to sing. I said, well, I don't know. If I have to sing, I sing. So I ended my story. I ended my That's the secret of life. Love and being loved in return, just like Jesus Christ said. You know, Jesus Christ, he gave his life, his love to us. And this is what we should give back. Love. We have problems in life, of course, but if you love enough, I think you can overcome. I don't want to get too philosophical either, because we're talking about life, and I think you just have to know how to interpret and feel the good things in life and give back some of it. Give back some of it with love.
Thank you very much. You said that your parents and grandparents were from elsewhere. How did they come to be in Panama?
My grandfather, he came to Panama for the French Canal. As far as I know, because we haven't done too much talking in our family, unfortunately. And just recently, after I retired, and I didn't say it, but with my English, I was fortunate to get a job in the Canal area with the UN United States Army. Because I went over there, I was studying architecture, and I went over there for an interview. I had worked 5 years with the government, the Panama government, in the construction field, in building and home, and I lost my job, so I put in. I never wanted to work on the canal zone, I'd be honest. Because of my father's experience, you know, I knew of a lot of things that was going on over there.
I mean, it's history, you know. There was a lot of discrimination. Lots of discrimination. Although the opportunity to live better was over there, but you really had to take a lot to get the money, you know. And I never wanted to work over there. Never did. And my brother, who was already a fireman over there, he said, Chichi, that's my nickname, you know. You better get your A over there and do that test, you know. Okay. I went and I did a test. I got something like 98, you know, with the kind of experience and the kind of knowledge that I had through studying, you know, Abel Bravo, Mr. Conner, University. I had 2 years of architecture already, and they called me for the interview, and that's another story, you know, just a short story. There were five of us interviewed. It was an American, but married to a Panamanian woman, so he spoke Spanish. But the interview was in English, you know, and he said, I had copied, I'm a calligrapher also, among other things, you know, because I copied the type of Palmer method that my sister was made to do at this Catholic school, you know, Palmer method. People even say, hey, you write like a woman, you know. I don't care. But he dictated a paragraph of about 30 words. So I did my best writing, finished it up. I was the last interview, and he said, very good. I like your English, and he even said something in your English that sounds different. I said, so where did you learn to speak English? And I said, of course, that's changed. I'm talking about 1964. Well, I studied out of a book called Royal. Oh, you learned the King's English. More or less. You know, and said, okay, you're going to be a gringo over here. You know, we talk different. You know, y'all and so forth. And I said, but I just wanted to say that you're not the best as far as numbers are concerned. You're the second of the five. He said, don't look now, the guy in the blue shirt and so forth, he already graduated as an architect. They were asking for a draftsman, a general draftsman, grade 4. That's GS4, NM, it was in Panama, non-manual. And something like $1.99 an hour. And I had two kids, recently married, you know, 3 years married, without a job. And then it was great then. That was great. $1.99 an hour. So he said, okay, you're the second best because the guy over there in the blue shirt, he already graduated. He was in school with me. We were in the same classrooms. I had dropped out because I got married and got into problems, you know. And then he said, but your English is good. This is what we need. This guy's an architect, and I see you have perfect handwriting. It's also great for doing drawings, you know, construction drawings and so forth. But this guy's an architect. We don't need an architect. We need a draftsman. And then again, I dictated a paragraph of about 30 words. You wrote two, and one was wrong. I said, we don't need that. So it's your job. I shouldn't say this. He did say it. I can say no because this guy died already. He's American. He said, the job is yours. The job is yours. We need somebody like you, you know. You have a driver's license? Sure. So, okay, we need somebody like you that is fluent in English, you know. And this is how I got into the army, the draftsman. And fortunate, I should say this, because of my type of education, because of my type of experience going through all this everything, they say I broke, not me, but my bosses, they broke every rule in the book, because when I was a grade 4, I jumped to grade 5, and in 3 months I was a 6, and in 3 other months I was a 7, because I had first the ability to speak in English.
They even had me, I didn't graduate as an architect, but they made me an engineering tech. They sent me over to the States a couple of times to study and so forth, you know, construction and concrete. And I turned out to be the specialist in paint. The coatings, they call it. They changed the name from paint to protective coatings, you know. And I was a coordinator for all the paintings in the United States Army for the Atlantic and Pacific. It was a good job. So I fortunately jumped from a 4, 5, 6, 7, and then I ended up as a grade 9, which was very good. Because of the ability to get around, you know. As a matter of fact, when there was a problem, there was an elderly American gentleman. He was in his 70s, maybe 80. And he was really old. I mean, getting around. He was one of the inspectors, the construction inspectors. And I remember well, they said, what was his name? Can't remember. But he retired. And then one day there was a problem with the general. He was the guy to go up there and calm down the general. The commanding general of the United States Army, Panama. And when he left, they started to call me. So that's where my PR, you know, public relations experience came also. So you can, I felt good, you know. So Ed Bamba said, come on, you're a troublemaker, because I had an answer for everything. I talked back. No, none of them could tell me I'm not going to be treated like they treated my father, you know, or whatever. But they respected me for it. They respected me for giving my opinion. So whenever a problem came up with the journal, the first thing I said, come on, Bama, I know you're a problem. Just don't make a big issue of it. Go on up there and talk to the general. And I'm at work. We have this problem, so. And I have letters at home, you know, from Lieutenant Colonel Wise and even the general and so forth. You know, the day I am saying this, I mean, this is boasting a bit. But the day I retired, they sent the XO, was a lady, she knew me. And she came to my, they gave me a big party. I mean, one of the expensive places here in Panama. The kids, I mean, my friends got together $30 a head at that time, 1996. I said, you sure you want to do this? I said, yes, Obama said. And she showed up, a white Caucasian XO for the commander and so forth. She said, I remember her words, you know, I have it taped. My daughter taped it. So, Mr. Obama said that has been an asset to the United States government, and I bring the personal, you know, congratulations from General so-and-so and so on, a letter. I felt great. So you can see, I can talk all day today and tomorrow about the good things of my life, you know. And how did, now, this is important. How did I get to where I was with these army people? It's because one day, I can say because they're not here in Panama anymore, and I don't think they will check back and see who was the commanding general of the engineers, you know. I had my trio. I think you saw a picture of my trio. And I went to the colonel one day and I said, hey, colonel, it's going to be Mother's Day in Panama. You know. And I would like to take 2 hours annual leave. I'm going to bring my friends over from Colón. I was working over in Corozal then. And I would like to sing to the mothers on Mother's Day. It's a serenade, what we call here in Panama and Latin America. And he said, okay, Ms. Bamseta. You sure you have nothing important doing this? I said, well, it's all done. You know, I talked to my boss and he says, I have to get your permission. That was the chief engineer. He was a colonel. So I went out there from building to building in the different divisions and I said, hello, ¿cómo están? Feliz Día de las Madres. And we sing a nice little bolero, very romantic and so forth. And I gave out flowers to the girls, you know. and walked over to the next building, and we did that for 2 hours. For those days, we had a train coming over, so my friends came over in the train. I picked them up at Corozal, put them back on the train for the 3 o'clock, go back to Colon time, you know. And the following year, I went to the colonel and I said, "Hey, colonel, remember last year I sang I would like to do it this year again?" He said, "Hey, Balmaceda, you go ahead. You don't need annual leave to do that. You have a good connection between Panama and us." You know. And I did it for about 5-6 years, and they never charged me any more the annual leave as far as I can remember. And then again, they, based on that, he organized, there was one girl that started it, then she called me to sing. There is an orphanage institution here in Panama called Malambo. So they decided to have a party for the orphanage at Corozal. The army go out and right there in Corozal and have a party for the kids. There were about 50 kids with the nuns and so forth, you know. And my friend called me and said, "Hey, Bama, why don't you come over and sing with me?" So we got the guys playing guitar, jingle bell, and that went on for about 10, 12 years. Every year we would have that. And we did this PR thing with the army for Panama, of course, our own people. This is why I say when I retired, they said, "Hey, Bama, we're going to give you a good send-off." And I said, "You don't need to do that." They fought. Some ladies, they fought among themselves. They said, "Hey, take it easy, you know. anything you do is okay for me." So they had this big party, you know. There were about 120 people went out there, $30 a piece. Wow. You know, and then they contracted a band. They had my trio after the third song. They said, "Okay, we didn't want you to play all night, just to show off a little your talent as a singer." And we had a great time. We had a great time. So you see, as I say, God has given it back to me. And more than I deserve, maybe. Well, I think as far as my work, as working is concerned, after that with the singing, you know, I belong to the Catholic Church. I have been singing Ave Maria with Mr. Gus Fring, who taught me that 52 years ago. And I had some great teachers. There was Mr. Carlos Grant, another Afro descendant, that he was a music teacher at the Abel Babu College. My teacher, my music teacher was Juan Hoyt, H-O-Y-T-E, I think that was. But I have had good people in my life as far as music is concerned. And then in 1996, after I decided, okay, let me see what I'm going to do, I did some translation work for some engineers that had to bid over in the canal area for the army and for Bank Canal. Okay, I did that for about 4 years, but my singing continued with my trio. And then maybe what I didn't say about the trio, that famous trio, the famous trio that nobody knew who we were. Although we sang on television over here in Panama a couple of times. It was just one day that my sister, we were very good friends. I mentioned the Quarles family who were neighbors, okay? My sister worked with her, we all had our jobs in English. My youngest sister, she is in Puerto Rico. She went over there and graduated as an English teacher 30-something years ago. So she's living over there. She's a retired English teacher. Then my sister worked, the fourth of us, she died already, but she worked for one of the companies, the shipping companies in Cristobal. And then Mr. Quarles, our one-time neighbor, had turned 75 years old. So she told, I was working then at Fort Davis as an inspector. And she said, "Look, can you bring your trio? I got permission to use a community club over in Fort Davis. And we're going to have a little party for Mr. Quarles. If you can just sing some songs here. There's no money." I said, "That's all right." I talked to my friends, you know. I said, okay. It's our family. So we sang some songs, and this guy came up to me in Spanish, and he said, "Oye, ven acá, ustedes son de Puerto Rico." And no, we're here from Cologne. Hey, you guys sing great, you know, and I like your singing. You want to play for us, you know, at the community club on Sundays? How much would you charge us? Okay, he said, give me a letter, and so forth. All right. I was working as in the engineers there in Fort Davis, so I typed up a letter and took it up there. The following week, he called me and said, all right, come on up. We are having a Sunday brunch. And for, I would say, more than 15 years, we played almost 17 years, I would say. Because it started out, we just wanted to sing to Mr. Qualis. And then it started in Fort Davis, and we jumped over. We played at every officers' club there was for the Army on the Atlantic or the Pacific side. So we, if we were not known here in Panama, we were well known over there. And there, as I said, I used it a lot without knowing as a PR. I remember once, my last job for the Army was a work order coordinator. You know, it was a desk job. They took me out of the field and said, okay, you're getting older, you can't climb roofs and so forth. So they gave me, that was my grade 9 job, as a work order coordinator. And we were playing out there. I had the telephone people. You know, I had 6 or 7 different customers. I remember it was the 56th Signal Battalion, whatever. You know, that was the first time I said, "Hey, what is this?" You know, because of my music. They all knew me out there. They would go out on Sunday brunches, you know. Hey, Mr. Marmosada, I was a guy, remember my work order and so forth. Until one day, two guys, a major, a Puerto Rican major, and another black guy, he was a lieutenant colonel. No, he was a major also. They came and said, "Mr. Marmosada, we'd like a word with you." I said, "Sure, got a problem," and, you know. I think my work orders are up. No. We have a new colonel coming in on Saturday. And we're going to take him up to the officer's club with his wife. So I want you to come over and sing to them and get me a special song and so forth. You know, we hear you singing a song in Spanish. So I said, okay, wait a minute. Okay. So Sunday, of course, I don't play hard to get. It's just I give everybody, okay, that's a colonel, you know. So we sang, so he, I said, okay, the way should turn, you know. So we just talk. I don't like to give the impression that I'm trying to favor anybody, and especially because of rank, you know. And they understood it. So we sang, we went to the table, and this colonel stood up. These are the impressed moments of my life, and especially on the job. This guy stood up and gave me a handshake. "Mr. Balmaceda, it is my pleasure to meet you. I've heard so many good things about you. Aside from the singing, is that right?" "Well, thank you, sir. It's my pleasure." "So for now, what are you going to sing for us?" "I'm not going to sing to you, I sing to your wife." I always, you know, kind of carry that way. I learned this thing from Frank Sinatra and Perry Como and those guys, you know. "No, I'm not going to sing to you, I'm going to sing to your wife. You want to listen, you can listen." Yeah, you carry it along with a joke and make it, you know, a real family type thing. And we enjoy ourselves. I think I sang to about 4 or 5 new colonels and the new general. The last general that came, they called me. "Hey, Balmaceda, we don't have a contract this Sunday. We make a contract for you." even Latin American style things, like we were at the officers' club singing our regular contract for the brunch, Sunday brunch. And these guys came up to us and say, hey, our colonel's birthday is today. How much would you charge us to go from here to Fort Clayton, you know, and just, we're going to meet at the top of the street, so and so and so and so, behind the hospital and so forth. He lives on number so and so. Of course, I know all the numbers of these buildings. And we'll all meet together, and you guys will be up front. And as soon as we hit the house, we'll say, cumpleaños, we sing it in Spanish, cumpleaños feliz, cumpleaños feliz. That was exciting. We made some extra bucks there, but I mean, it was a PR thing for me. And then, music, that's my life as a musician. Be coming in, I guess, in the next half an hour, because if he calls me at 2 o'clock, I figure he's going to be here at 3:30.
Okay, so that's the only thing. We're fine.
Okay.
We're fine. I just wanted to make sure that you were...
Okay, I have a long, long story.
You need to... No, that's why I said we would see this as...
Let me know when I'm...
And we'll see this as...
My action is in term, it was about zero. We only have 45 minutes left.
Oh, no, that was for the kids.
For the kids, yeah, because they have to go back to their five classes. Yeah.
6, 5, 8.
Let me change this right.
I'm
going to
run out.
Okay. I've
got a
bunch for
now.
Okay.
Can I use your bathroom as open,
right?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. How are you going?
Oh,
you didn't eat.
Just No, it's not that. It's that I wanted, you know, I told you my initial conversation I had with them was that I wanted to take the staff, you know. I wanted them to be part of it.